Good morning. My name is Lauren Schulbro from the Bassford Remley Law Firm. I'm appearing as a Special Assistant Public Defender today on behalf of the appellant in this matter, Mr. Jeremy Allen Giles. As we stand here today, there has been no published opinion from this court or the Minnesota Supreme Court providing guidance on the evidentiary search permitted under Arizona versus Gant.
I think the state agrees with you that the first prong of that doesn't apply here. It's just the second prong.
That's correct, Your Honor. So the evidentiary search that is permitted under Arizona versus Gant says that it provides that a search incident to arrest is lawful, quote, when it is reasonable to believe that evidence relevant to the crime of arrest might be found in the vehicle. And that evidentiary search provided by Gant derives from Justice Scalia's concurrence in the 2004 case, United States versus Thornton. In that case, Justice Scalia noted that it was reasonable for the arresting officer to search the vehicle from which the arrestee had just come after finding drugs on his person. It was reasonable to believe that the vehicle from which he came would have further evidence of the crime of arrest, which was possession of drugs. In this case, we don't have that situation. What we have here is the driver of the vehicle in which Mr. Giles was traveling was arrested for driving while intoxicated for a controlled substance. The officer then returned to the vehicle to search. However, evidence relevant to the crime of arrest, which was driving while intoxicated, was intrinsic to the driver's body, and there was no reasonable evidentiary value to returning to the car to search it. There wouldn't be evidence of her blood or urine in the car.
So what if your client had been falling down drunk on alcohol? Do you think that the officers could have gone and looked for bottles of alcohol in the car as evidence of that crime?
Well, that would be evidence, Your Honor, of a separate crime of open container. Evidence of the crime of arrest is, again, it's in the driver's body. So,
but how it got there would be evidence of the crime, perhaps.
Not necessarily, especially in a case like this one where there's more than one person in the vehicle.
I think your answer is no to Judge
yes,
Riley's question. Under Gant, you would say that officer that suspects falling, you know, based on falling down drunk, is not able to enter the vehicle and look for, say, an open bottle.
That's correct.
Okay.
I'm sorry if I wasn't direct in my answer.
No, I just wanted to make sure.
Yes.
But I think that's what she said.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. And especially in a case like this where we have no testimony from the officer that there is, for example, where there is a driving while intoxicated arrest, it's more likely than not that you'd find evidence or you'd find a contraband in the vehicle. Like I mentioned, we're going off of just Gant.
Well, let's just stop there for a second, and maybe I don't understand your comment, but you seem to be saying that on the facts of this case, the officer had no reasonable, articulable suspicion that there would be contraband in the car. You know, even assuming he could make the leap from you are driving under the influence of a controlled substance to is there a controlled substance in your vehicle, which is, as you said, that's a separate crime. That's certainly
correct.
Factually accurate. You're saying that the officer had no basis for it, where I read his testimony as saying, actually I was suspecting some kind of contraband, either a gun based on some of my initial contact, remember the flashlight through the windshield, as well as some of the conduct by the driver, but that was earlier. And then in addition, while the officer was conducting the field sobriety tests, Giles kind of pushed back against him, tried to go beyond him and go back to the vehicle, all of which the officer said led him to think there's something in the vehicle.
Right, and I'll just clarify for a moment, Mr. Giles was not the driver of the vehicle.
Yeah,
he was a passenger, so
that's
I'll just
right.
clarify
Thank
that
you.
Point.
Yep, I am talking about the driver, not Mr. Giles.
Yes.
That's right. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay, and I would point to the fact that, first of all, any testimony that the officer offered about so-called furtive gestures or furtive movements, the district court made no such finding. The district court noted that the movements may have been unusual. And even if we are looking at a furtive movements analysis, I think those furtive movements would be toward the, you know, would go toward not the crime of arrest, that doesn't go toward she's trying to hide her intoxication by these movements, or it requires a separate probable cause analysis, which I can address separately. But we're still stuck at the language from the Supreme Court that is evidence relevant to the crime of arrest. I'm not suggesting that there's, I suppose the Officer Fiebelkorn could point to no objective fact that there was evidence of the crime of arrest, which would be driving while intoxicated in the vehicle.
So the district court says that based on the observations that the driver was driving under the influence, he was therefore permitted to search the driver's area for evidence of a controlled substance. That's where you say the analysis falls down. In this case, the court goes on and says that because he found a hypodermic needle on the driver's side, the officer then could expand the search to all of the car. But it's the second point that is the weak link in this case for you as you analyze it, right?
No.
Okay.
I believe it's when the officer made the decision to go back and search the vehicle. He said, and I think the district court does splice the concepts of search incident to arrest and the automobile exception as well, which requires separate independent probable cause, which also is not met by the circumstances of this case.
I don't think the state argues that there was probable cause to have believed that the vehicle contained contraband.
Respectfully, Your Honor, the state did argue that below.
Right,
and
but now we're talking only about reasonable suspicion based on GAN, right?
The state in their responsive brief argued both.
Okay.
So I'm prepared to address both because I think those concepts are being spliced. Gantt, right, there is no standard. This court even acknowledged in an unpublished opinion that the standard for this evidentiary search under Gantt is a bit wishy-washy. We don't know what the standard is. That's in the State versus Lee decision from 2015. And that court took a, and that court, so in State versus Lee, there was the driver of a car was arrested for suspicion of engaging in credit card fraud. This individual had just been seen with a credit card and had just been seen getting in their vehicle. It was reasonable, therefore, to expect that there would be evidence linked to the crime of arrest in the vehicle. So I'll leave Gantt for just a moment and go to the probable cause analysis, which I think the facts and the arguments get a bit spliced with. If we're talking about furtive movements, then that goes towards, like I said, the furtive movements were allegedly in relation to some controlled substance in the vehicle. But I'll, again, like I said, the furtive movements, there was no finding by the district court. But those furtive movements, even if they were to be considered fairly furtive movements, were not coupled with any specific knowledge on the part of the officer that there was contraband in the vehicle. For example, in State versus Gallagher, which is where our probable cause or where our furtive movement doctrine comes from, we have a passenger in a vehicle who is shifting her body awkwardly to try to shield the officer from viewing a brown paper bag on the floor of the vehicle, which the officer believed to be suspicious that she was trying to shield that from his view. In this case, we don't have that. In this case,
well, what do we have? Why don't you describe the officer's testimony? I tried earlier and didn't do it very well.
So. Yeah, of course. Yeah. So the officer testified that he approached the vehicle. He
talking about the initial approach.
The initial approach, mm-hmm. Correct. Right. The officer approached the vehicle. Ms. Rathai, the driver, she said, "I'm going to grab my insurance information now." And then the officer testified that he saw her hand reach into the quote-unquote unknown.
Well, does it make a difference backing up that there was all this kind of odd driving? How does that figure into the analysis?
I don't believe it does. There's no, based on the testimony presented, she drove in a circle. after the police officer had learned that she was from out of town.
But she was going towards a school which was closed.
That's correct. And as Mr. Giles' eventual testimony showed, she was lost. But in the moment, Officer Feeblecorn knew that he ran her plates and saw that she was not from Glencoe.
Well, that the owner of the vehicle was not from Glencoe.
And she was the owner of the vehicle.
He didn't know that when he ran the plates, did he?
I believe he did.
He?
I believe he did, based on my understanding of the record.
Okay.
And
well, okay, maybe I'm confused. Did he run the plates after he stopped her?
No. So what happened was he saw her pass on a perpendicular street toward the high school. She turned around, came back, and then passed his vehicle. And as she passed, he noted her license.
How would he know who the female driver is, whether it's the owner or not?
I'm not sure if he knew which of the two of them were driving, but...
Well, even if he, you know, maybe he didn't even know the gender, there's no way he would know who it was driving the car. All he'd know is that it's the license plate is registered to someone from Buffalo Lake or wherever it was.
That's what the district court said, ran the license plate of the vehicle and learned that the registered owner was Jamie Rathai?
Rathai.
Buffalo.
Even so, I don't think this couples with any objective knowledge on the part of the police officer that there's contraband in the vehicle. He's not acting on a tip that there's contraband in the vehicle. He's not. He doesn't have personal knowledge of either of the occupant of the vehicle's criminal histories. He doesn't see a needle in the car when he's flashing around his light. And I'll return to Judge Bradfield's question about his testimony. When Ms. Rathai said, "I'm reaching for my driver's license or my insurance information," he believed it was awkward that she was reaching into the unknown, quote unquote, unknown near the center console. And then moments later, he said, "You know what happened next?"
He goes, "Wasn't it?" In the officer's testimony, it wasn't just the way that she was reaching into the unknown. It was that she's looking at the officer. I believe that's the testimony.
Correct.
He felt it was odd behavior, and I mean, I'm not trying to suggest that a different officer couldn't have reached a different conclusion. I'm only looking for your analysis of why that. Again, it's not just that one part of the officer's testimony, but the totality of the officer's testimony doesn't meet the standard.
Correct. And later on, when asked on cross-examination...
I know that's your position. I want to understand how you see how you would articulate that evidence falls short of the legal standard.
It falls short. Okay, it falls short because under Gallagher, any sort of furtive movement needs to be coupled with some objective knowledge that the furtive movement is connected to
the contraband, right?
Correct.
And so that's why you look at the Gallagher case and the brown paper bag. I'm trying to understand what's the correct analogy between Gallagher and this case. We've got our drivers doing different things. I mean, you're going to have different facts in every single case. But we do have the driver making gestures toward an area of the car. That's what's described by the officer.
Correct.
Explain to me why this is not like the record that was recognized in Gallagher.
Because Ms. Rathai eventually moments later, gives the very document she said she was reaching for, and also because Officer Feeblecorn didn't observe anything that she was trying to hide or conceal with those movements.
But then go to the next part of the officer's testimony, because that's what leads the officer to go back to the vehicle after he arrests the driver. It's based on her conduct during the field sobriety test.
Right. She tried to return to the vehicle.
Right.
And... again, though, that does not meet the standard of a furtive movement. As Gallagher presses, there are innocent explanations for a person's movements. At this point, he still had not seen anything in the vehicle that would lead him to believe that there was controlled substances. Also, it was a cold evening, and he had already established that she was intoxicated. There's plenty of innocent explanations for why someone might return to their vehicle on a cold night like that.
You challenged the initial stop as well, based on the driver not having formulated an intention to turn until she got to the intersection. Very creative argument. It seems to me, the way I read the statute, the intention refers to the signal of intention to turn. That's a description of the signal, as opposed to the moment in time when a person formulates the intention to turn. Doesn't seem unusual to me. I oftentimes, you know, you drive to a place, you're like, which way is that building? Is it to the right or to the left? You drive up to the intersection, you're not really signaling because you don't know yet. Now you start signaling. Have I violated the statute or haven't I when I do that?
I believe you have, and that's why it is.
But then the police officer can stop me, right? I didn't signal my intention to turn until I was at the intersection. You can go ahead and answer it.
Okay. Yes, but under these circumstances where, again, we know that the officer knew that she was from out of town.
We don't know that, I don't think. We know that he knew that the owner of the vehicle was from out of town.
Right, and I would agree with Your Honor. And if I could just
go ahead. You can
finish
answer.
Up. Okay.
It's a good argument, but I want to press you a little bit on what that word intention refers to.
Okay. Would you like me to respond to that now?
Please.
Okay. I believe it does refer to the intention to turn. The signal is the intent that you will take the turn. If Ms. Rathai has informed that intention, then it's...
Then she doesn't have to signal.
Correct.
Okay. Well, we can come back to it on rebuttal if appropriate.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. So in sum, Mr. Giles asked that the court reverse the district court's denial of the suppression motion under the Gantt search incident to arrest the evidentiary search. And then pursuant to Mr. Giles and the state's agreement, this court should then vacate his conviction and dismiss this matter in his favor. Thank you.
You will have 5 minutes on rebuttal. The state...
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Dan Preventure. I am an assistant McLeod County attorney, and I'm here representing the state of Minnesota.
How are the roads this morning?
They're fine.
Good.
On the highways, side streets are a little different. It's cold walking in, but other than that, it's okay. One thing I want to touch on, which I, after reading my brief, I don't think I did quite justice, is the fact that the driver, Ms. Rathai, tried to get back into the vehicle, I think is extremely important. And I think it's important for all three bases for what I argued in my brief. I also want to briefly touch on the fact that, Judge Rodenberg, you mentioned that there's not a reasonable, articulable suspicion. That's kind of what the Gantt concurrence, what the holding is. And I disagree. The Supreme Court used the language might find in the vehicle. If the Supreme Court had wanted, they could have said it's reasonable to believe that the officer has reasonable, articulable suspicion, but they chose to use the word might.
Yeah, but if you just use the word might in the, I mean, that, I suppose you might find contraband in any of the cars parked in the parking lot outside.
If it's reasonable to believe that, based on the crime of arrest. So there's a separate couple of factors that have to go into it before you get to that might. So, for instance...
So, is this the part of Gantt you're referring to? Police may search the passenger compartment of a vehicle incident to a recent occupant's arrest only if it is reasonable to believe that the arrestee might access the vehicle.
That's No, Your Honor.
So, you think there's another might?
Correct. So...
The other part of the sentence says, or that the vehicle contains evidence of the offense of arrest. Not that it might contain.
Correct. So in the opinion itself, they mention the exact quote you just said, but they also quote Justice Scalia in saying, might find in the vehicle. So the fact that they quote him directly and say, as appellant's counsel has stated a couple of times, that's kind of the standard of review that both Minnesota appellate courts as well as the other courts I've cited to, they talk about that specific portion, whether or not it's reasonable to believe you might find evidence.
Well, the exact quote, or it is reasonable to believe the vehicle contains evidence of the offense of arrest.
That's one portion of the holding. The other portion of the opinion also quotes the Justice Scalia in his concurrence specifically. And other courts and Minnesota appellate courts have looked at the
quoted
portion.
I see the quote you're looking at.
From okay. Thornton.
Yeah, right. From Thornton.
Correct,
got
from
it.
The concurrence. And so...
And I, you know, I'm not sure we want to spend a lot of time on what the difference is between might and reasonable belief. It's up to you. It's your time to argue. But I think the focus that I'm hearing from appellant's counsel is crime of arrest, that our crime of arrest here is driving while intoxicated under the influence of controlled substances. That is one crime. It does not get support. Gantt does not support the state's argument that it gives the officer finding that crime, evidence of that crime during the field sobriety tests, et cetera, gives the officer an opportunity to expand the search and now return to the vehicle and open it up and proceed. So that's the argument I'd like to hear you address, is that Gant seems to be focused on the offense of arrest, not sure. Other offenses.
So understood. So obviously the state disagrees, and the state's argument is that, is it reasonable to believe you're going to find evidence of the crime of arrest? The crime of arrest here is controlled substance DUI. The officer said, based on my training and experience, I thought it was reasonable to think there was evidence of the crime of arrest in the vehicle. And one of the things
but a crime of arrest, so controlled substance use while driving a vehicle, that evidence would be found in her body. I'm just looking for your answer to the appellant's argument. And you're talking about a different offense, which is possession of, paraphernalia or possession of a controlled substance.
So not necessarily. Okay. Whether or not there's going to be relevant evidence, and I cited the court, I think Rule 401 or 403, I forget which one, talks about what relevant evidence is. Mm-hmm. And at this point, all we know is that the officer believed, based on his training and experience, that this driver was under the influence. There's possibilities that there's no blood test, there's no urine test, so we have no idea what is actually in her system. All we'd have is a generic, at the time of arrest, a generic controlled substance DUI. Is there any more evidence that's more probative of whether or not this person's under the influence than the fact that you might find drugs themselves or paraphernalia? So the crime of arrest being a generic DWI, finding paraphernalia, even if it's just a pipe without any a legal pipe, a tobacco pipe, but based on the officer's training and experience at trial, he's able to say, this is a methamphetamine pipe. I believe she was under the influence of a stimulant, specifically methamphetamine. Therefore, that's some of the most relevant evidence. The fact that you have drugs or have a pipe inside of the vehicle would be extremely relevant at trial regarding a generic controlled substance DUI.
So I don't know if you have in mind Judge Riley's earlier hypothetical, but it was the question related to, say, the officer, similar scenario, but suspects driving while under the influence, falling down drunk, so of intoxication by alcohol. So in your opinion, Gant would authorize the officer to return to the vehicle and look for, say, open bottles?
If it's reasonable to believe that the officer thinks he would find it. And, as appellant's counsel stated, it might be best at district court level to flush out the fact that in 80% or 90% of alcohol DWIs, they find an open bottle or something to that effect. But whether or not it's reasonable to think you're going to find an open bottle in a vehicle when you have a drunk driver, it seems like a reasonable logical conclusion that you might find evidence of the crime of arrest of alcohol DWI in the vehicle.
I want to ask an odd question.
Okay.
So I understand how the officer could see eyelid tremors and rigid arms and things like that. How did he see heat bumps on her tongue?
And so the record's not developed, but from my experience, the officers, when they suspect somebody's been using methamphetamine, will say, hey, can I look in your mouth? That wasn't challenged, whether or not that was a consent search. I've seen that challenged at district court in the past and had to argue that. But my assumption, and it's not in the record, is that the officer asked, can I take a look in your mouth? Because that's my experience.
And so what do heat bumps look like?
White. Like burn marks, if you've ever grabbed a hot pot where you get the little blister on your finger, it's little bumps on the back of somebody's tongue, is my understanding. So just to shift focus away from Gant, because I think the state has three independent arguments that are all sufficient for searching this vehicle. If you look at the furtive movements portion, the officer and the district court found his testimony, included his facts as part of the district court's opinion. The officer said that while making eye contact with him, the driver started reaching with her right hand into the center console area, into the unknown where he couldn't see, to the point that he shifted his body in order to be able to shine his flashlight on her. And he testified that, based on his training and experience, that was highly unusual. He said, I found it to be unusual and odd behavior. Officers are allowed to make conclusions and take a step further than the general population might not, based on their training and experience, and that's throughout the case law. So the fact that the officer...
In the judge's order, though, the judge doesn't talk about furtive movements. I mean, talks about how...
Not specifically.
He reaches in an odd way, but it's not really furtive because it's totally within his sight.
Says that the officer Fiebelkorn could not observe while the driver was making eye contact with him, which the officer thought was unusual.
So right. I think you're in the findings of fact.
I am.
Now from the district court. I mean, the part I was looking at, the district court's opinion, and I'm not sure what Judge Harley was, the district court doesn't mention that. Doesn't mention the driver's movements when it comes to her analysis of the search of the vehicle. So I'm looking at the addendum on page 6.
Sure. So the district court obviously just ruled essentially on the Gantt issue. But in looking at page 3 in the facts, the judge does make a finding, which is deferred to, that this was unusual behavior and it was odd. So when you have that kind of movement combined with the fact that the driver was under the influence, combined with the fact that the driver tried to push past the officer back into the vehicle, I think it's a reasonable conclusion based on the totality of the circumstances that these furtive movements combined with, as in Gallagher, somebody being under the influence, and this goes even a step further than Gallagher, in that the driver tried to push past him to get back into the vehicle. So the state believes that it has that independent basis for the court to find that the search was reasonable. Plain view is, I would agree, is the weakest of the three arguments.
Those two things the district court did not make findings about, in my judgment.
Pushing past the...
This whole furtive movement thing, mm-hmm. the unusual reference to about the eye contact had to do with whether, the way I read her order, has to do with whether she was under the influence.
So are you on page 3, Your Honor, of the district court's opinion? So
yeah. It says Fiebelkorn could not observe while maintaining eye contact with Officer Fiebelkorn, which Officer Fiebelkorn thought was unusual. This is when she's doing this reaching, but she's looking at him thing. But then he asked for driver's license and insurance, which she produces. And then while speaking with Rathai, Officer Fiebelkorn believed Rathai was under the influence based upon all these things. So it seems like the unusual wasn't like she looked to be hiding something under the seat, or I thought I saw her with a gun, or that sort of things that we hear about with furtive movements that lead to probable cause. This unusual seems like part of the way she was behaving because she was under the influence of methamphetamine.
Sure, and the district court might have already had in mind that they weren't going to fall back on the furtive movements, was going to decide on the kind of the Gantt issue. But the fact that the district court found that it was, the officer found it unusual and that it was out of his eyesight, I think is enough to draw the conclusion.
It might be, but that's my point. The district court did not go on to say, and by the way, by the virtue of these unusual behaviors, that suggests something leads to probable cause. The district court never made those findings, right?
Made the findings of fact that we've been discussing, but didn't then apply it to the furtive movement argument and the legal conclusions.
Right. It seems like if we were going to go down that road, that's a district court job to say, okay, if the search is bad on this basis, then was there probable cause? And you'd have to have a whole bunch of findings, like what exactly was going on and what did Officer Fiebelkorn see, and do I believe what Officer Fiebelkorn said that he saw, et cetera.
And so I would respond by saying the fact that we have, although albeit a very short, brief statement about these movements, the fact that it's there and that this court defers to the district court's findings of fact and then reviews the law de novo, I think this court can apply the law to that fact and find, based on the officer's observation, which he thought was unusual, and the courts defer to officers' conclusions and findings, the fact that the district court found just that specific fact, I think, is enough for this court to review the law on furtive movements and review the rest of the facts, which, as I mentioned, trying to go back to the vehicle, as well as her failed field sobriety, I think is enough for Your Honors to find that furtive movements is a basis to the officer to be allowed to search the vehicle. Just to briefly touch on the stop issue, I agree, obviously, with Judge Rodenberg. I think I put in a footnote that the fact that the driver maybe was lost, the statute's really just referring to the signal itself. It's a poor...
Intention refers to what kind of a signal.
Exactly. It's
not the brake lights, not the headlights, the signal of intention to turn.
And if you look at the other, the portion of the statute, I said it in my footnote, the definitional statute says signal of intention to turn. It talks about that. So I think it's pretty clear if you look at that other statute that signal of intention to turn is just another way of saying turn signal.
Turn signal.
But even if we take the appellant's version of the intention, I think appellant's confusing proof beyond a reasonable doubt, probable cause, with reasonable articulable suspicion. Even if that is what the legislature meant when they talked about intention to turn, how would the officer possibly know whether or not this person's lost, whether or not the person's being negligent, or if their turn signal doesn't work? If it's either of those latter two, it gives the officer a reasonable articulable suspicion to stop this vehicle. So I think that the appellant's version, even if you take it on its face, that the intention language is talking about the driver's intention, which I think I put in another footnote, you could extend out to a whole host of other specific intent crimes and say officers can't stop vehicles. So the state obviously disagrees with the final conclusion of the appellant, but even taking the appellant's version of that definition still believes that the argument fails. And so just to conclude, Your Honors, I think when you look at Gantt, I think you have to take into account all the circumstances. I know that Gantt specifically talks about the crime of arrest, but all searches you fall back on, is it reasonable under a totality of the circumstances? And so when you look at the circumstances here, you have somebody making furtive movements out of the officer's line of sight to the point that he has to move his body to shine a light in. You have failed field sobriety tests. Then you have the driver trying to push past the officer to get back in. So is it reasonable for the officer to believe that evidence of the crime of arrest might be found in the vehicle? Why is she trying to push past him? Why is she trying to get back in the vehicle? Why is she hiding her hand? And so I see I'm out of time, and therefore I would ask that Your Honors affirm the district court. Thank you.
Thank you. Does the appellant wish to use rebuttal time?
Thank you, Your Honors, and I'd like to focus my rebuttal on the Gantt and or on the lawfulness of the stop. I believe that there are several points I'd like to address. First of all, the district court made absolutely no findings about Ms. Rathai's motions during the field sobriety test. She didn't make any findings that Ms. Rathai, that it was unusual or furtive that she pushed past the officer or tried to walk past him. And again, made no, as Your Honors observed, made no finding that there was a furtive movement. And going back to the language in Gantt, I'd just like to address counsel's argument that the focus on the might in there certainly doesn't allow an officer to search a vehicle on pure speculation. That's contrary to basic Fourth Amendment law or precedent. But also, it's contrary to Gantt itself. The purpose for which the Supreme Court took review in Gantt was to clarify the situations under which a search incident to arrest was lawful, because as the court had had noted, it was concerned that the Belton rule was being expanded too expansively, such that there had been a bright line rule that if arrest, then search. And So to say that the might would permit speculative searches of a car when there's a DWI arrest to search for possession is clearly contrary to Gantt and Thornton.
Well, and you're certainly right that Gantt pulled back on Belton to the extent that it's stated in, you know, very again, each of these cases, very fact-specific. The crime of arrest in Gantt, I believe, was suspended license, right?
That's correct.
And so, I mean, what possible evidence could have been found in the vehicle related to suspended license? But would you address respondent's argument that this might have been a situation where the officer was unable to obtain blood or urine or other evidence of to confirm his belief based on the field sobriety test that the driver was driving under the influence of a controlled substance?
Certainly. We have no testimony from Officer Feeblecorn that it is more likely than not that when there's an individual suspected of driving under the influence that there would be a controlled substance in the car. And common sense would tell us that just because there's a controlled substance in the car also doesn't mean that somebody is intoxicated by it. These are two very separate concepts.
Don't you think that if a person is arrested for driving while under the influence of a controlled substance, that the existence of controlled substance in the car makes it, is relevant to the question of whether that person is under the influence of that substance?
I would disagree. What's relevant is what's in the driver's blood and urine and body.
And that's the only thing?
I believe so. I mean, you can't prove a DWI case, or there's no element that the in the DWI statute that somebody has the intoxicant on their person.
To be sure, but I mean, oftentimes the proof in a DWI case includes, oh, and by the way, there was beer cans strewn throughout the front seat. Seems like it's relevant evidence.
It certainly is. It would be relevant evidence of an open container law violation.
Oftentimes they're empty because the person has consumed them.
Sure, but in this case, again, what we have is more than one individual in the vehicle. And we have an officer that had absolutely no objective fact by which to return to the vehicle and search it. He didn't see anything. And even if he didn't see anything, what concerns me about the state's argument and what is being done in McLeod County is it's if arrest for DWI, then search. Officer Feeblecorn on page 33 of the transcript even said so himself, that when he pulls someone over for a DWI for alcohol, he returns and searches the vehicle. It seems that the state would have this court issue an opinion saying that there is a bright line rule that where there's a DWI arrest, an officer gets a free ticket to go back and search the vehicle based on no objective evidence or objective suspicion that there is contraband in the car. Again, that seems very contrary to Gant and Thornton, on which this search is based. So in conclusion, unless the court has any more questions, I would just ask that the court vacate Mr. Reverse the district court's decision and vacate Mr. Giles's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. The matter is submitted. We thank both of counsel for your briefing and argument. We'll issue our decision within 90 days.